Chapter 32. Greg woke to find he couldn't move. His toes and fingers were tingling, not so much pins and needles as pokers and knives, the aftermath of a stun-shot charge. Arms and legs ached dully, guts knotted tight, rumbling ominously, a livid collection of aggravated bruises and scrapes. His cortical node prevented the worst peaks of neural fire from stabbing into his brain. But the cumulative effect was atrocious. He opened his eyes, seeing grayness distorted by octagonal splash patterns. His whole body was quivering now, drumming against whatever hard surface he was lying on. The tingling bloomed into a sandpaper rasp, which the cortical node hurriedly muted. Consciousness seemed like nothing but constant suffering. He instructed the node to disengage his nerves altogether. Sensation fell away, leaving him alone in gray nothingness. He closed his eyes and slept. At the second awakening, his thoughts were clearer. He'd stopped bucking, still on his back and unable to move. Genuine tactile sensation had replaced the tingling. The surface he was lying on was vibrating faintly. Heavy machinery, somewhere not too far away. A stifled, monotonous hum backed the supposition. He opened his eyes again, focusing slowly. Gabriel was lying beside him, shuddering, in the throes of stun-shot backlash. Her mouth gaped, drooling beads of saliva. Greg tried to reach out to her. Found his hands were immobilized under his back. There was a rigid bracelet about each wrist, bolted to the floor. It was the same for his ankles. Bloody uncomfortable. They were in a small, empty compartment, metal walls, metal floor, metal ceiling. Painted gray. The only light was coming through a grill in the door. Greg blinked at that door, haunted by its familiarity. It was rectangular with curved corners, fastened by bulky latches. The last time he'd seen that particular arrangement was on board the Miriam. Oh, shit. And underway, too, by the sound of it. Thinking logically, they'd have to be heading down the Neen, or up. No, the river wasn't deep enough to take the Miriam west of Peterborough. The Wash and the open sea, then. Next question, why? Not just to dump them overboard. There were far simpler ways to dispose of bodies. Besides, Kendrick had gone to a great deal of trouble snatching them alive. Nothing pleasant. 100% cert.
Greg?
Gabriel's voice was tiny, fearful.
Greg, it's gone.
What has?
His own voice wasn't much better.
No, wait. Think before you speak. Remember, they'll probably be listening.
Bugger that. My precognition won't work. I don't know what's going to happen to us.
You really gave your gland a workout snatching Katerina, remember? We all have to throttle back occasionally. Nature never intended our brains to take the psi strain.
Shut up and listen, asshole. There is absolutely nothing. I can't see a second into the future. I don't even know what you're going to say.
He could hear the fright bubbling through her voice. She was holding back a long, terrified scream. Hear it, but not sense it. The corrosive throb of overdriven synapses had faded. He'd must have been out for several hours. He'd recuperated enough to use the gland again. It began to discharge a murky cloud of neurohormones. But that secret gate into the Psi universe remained firmly shut. He couldn't even perceive the glow of Gabriel's mind, not 50 centimeters from his own.
Impossible.
His skin crawled, goosebumps rising at the black sense of deprivation. Mortal again. After 15 years, it was hard.
Me too, Greg said. Not a peep.
The breath came out of her in a whoosh. She let her head rest on the decking, staring into a private purgatory.
What have they done to us, Greg?
They haven't done anything to us. You were using precognition right up until the duo crashed. We didn't eat anything dodgy. We certainly weren't infused with anything.
What then?
Must be something which affects Psi directly.
What?
She shouted.
I don't fucking know. Ask Kendrick. He's the one into pilfering new discoveries before they even make it out of the laboratory.
Gabriel closed roomy eyes in anguish.
Funny. I always thought I didn't want to see the end coming. Now I'm sure it is coming. I'd like to see it. Not knowing is too much like cold turkey.
Silly girl. You just want to see which of our escape plans works the best.
Escape plans?
She snorted in a resigned amusement, which nudged disapprobation.
Sure, Greg. Sure.
After a while, she asked,
"What do you think they want us for?"
"Information. They want to know what we've discovered of their operation. How much of that we've told Walshaw. Once they know that, they'll see what they can salvage. Hopefully that isn't going to be much. We've done a pretty good job up to now."
"Great. That makes me feel one hell of a lot better."
She lapsed into sullen silence. Greg guessed they'd been lying in the blank metal cell for a couple of hours before the hatch swung open. It was Mark who drew the latches, accompanied by two more of Kendricks's bodyguards. A bioloom came on above them. After hours of dusk, the glare sent Greg's tear ducts into frantic action.
"Still on your backs?" Mark gloated. "I thought I'd be pulling you off each other by now. Or aren't you up to that? Maybe fancy something different? Animals and the like. I heard you gland freaks are kind of warped."
Gabriel glared at him silently, realizing just how nasty things could turn if she started antagonizing him. Mark bent down and released Greg's legs with a complex-looking mechanical key. Greg was jerked roughly to his feet. Every ache and pain suddenly doubled in intensity. His legs nearly collapsed as a wave of nausea hit him. He saw the front of his dress shirt was stained by a long ribbon of dried blood. His nose had been bleeding again while he'd been unconscious. One of the bodyguards supported him as he stumbled out into the corridor. He didn't possess anything like the ostentation of the upper decks. Pipes ran along the walls. Red letters were stenciled across small hatches. The engine noise was more pronounced. Another three bodyguards were waiting for him outside, including Toby, who glowered with unconcealed menace.
"Christ," Greg croaked. "I must scare you lot shitless. Going to have you, white boy," Toby whispered dangerously. "Gonna take you a fucking part."
"Not yet, Toby," Mark said, pushing a shaky Gabriel ahead of him.
"When the man has finished with him."
Greg was marched up and out onto the afterdeck. The sun was nearly full overhead. Well over 6 hours since they'd been snatched from the duo. Would Walshaw have noticed? He'd told the security chief he would help to analyze the data in the craze, but he hadn't given a specific time. Of course, Eleanor would be frantic, but would she ring Walshaw? And even if she did, there was nothing to make him look here. At least he'd been right about here. The Miriam was sailing sedately down the Neen. The course the Neen took for the first 30 kilometers east of Peterborough was a new one. The PSP's delay in authorizing construction of the city's port meant that the old river course had been lost at the start of the warming, disappearing beneath the water and silt, which laid siege to the city boundaries. A couple of years later, when the wharf's foundations were being laid, the dredgers cut a straight line from the port right out to the old estuary at Tidgoat. Miriam was following a huge container freighter out towards the wash. There was another freighter trailing a couple of kilometers behind. They were the only things moving in a very confined universe. All Greg could see was river, sky, and high jean-tailored coral levees covered in tall, stringy reeds. The tide was full, just beginning to turn, showing a thin line of chocolate mud below the bottom of the reeds. Miriam seemed to be losing ground on the freighter in front. Greg glanced over the taffrail to see four crewmen inflating two odd-looking craft on the edge of the diving platform. They were blunt-nosed dinghies with a couple of simple benches strung between the triplex tubing that formed the sides. A loose surplus of leathery fabric ran round the outside. It was only after a big fan, caged in a protective mesh, hinged up to the vertical at the rear of one of the dinghies, Greg realized they were actually hovercraft. Gabriel nudged him, and he turned to see Kendrick approaching. Miriam's owner was wearing olive-green tracksuit trousers and a light waterproof jacket. Hermione was at his side, as always, dressed in natty designer equivalents of her husband's attire. But it was the woman keeping a short distance behind who held Greg's attention. She was in her late 20s, with a second chin just beginning to develop. Her dumpy face was framed by straight, jet-black hair, cut in a fringe along her eyebrows, falling to her shoulders at the sides. Her skin was dark and leathery, heavily wrinkled from excessive sun exposure. He was convinced that she was the woman he'd seen at the ambush. He could still see her slightly bulky frame in that trio walking calmly down the road. Kendrick's gaze swept across Greg and Gabriel, utterly unperturbed. A cattleman, checking his stock.
"Put them in with Rod and Laurie," Kendrick said to Mark. "You and Toby come with us."
"Yes, sir," Mark replied.
"Postponed," Toby muttered in Greg's ear. "That's all."
"Right, get them down there," Mark was saying.
Kendrick and Hermione began to descend the ladder to the diving platform. The crewmen were holding the fully rigged hovercraft steady in Miriam's wake.
"You have to take our cuffs off," Greg pointed out.
"Maybe we'll just throw you down," said Toby.
"Take 'em off," Mark said. "And you two, don't think about jumping."
Greg just managed to climb down to the ladder, frightened his weak, trembling hands were going to lose their grip. He flopped down in the bottom of a hovercraft, exhausted and horribly woozy. Gabriel sat on a bench next to him, breathing heavily. One of the crewmen cuffed them both again.
"Are you all right?"
Gabriel asked, her face anxious.
"Yeah."
He heard the fan start up, an incessant droning whine. There was a surge of motion, then the deck tilted up as they climbed the levee wall. The dizziness returned. When they were down the other side, he struggled into a sitting position against the tough plastic of the gunwale, trying to take an interest in the journey. The sour-faced woman was perched on the rear bench, her waterproof zippered up against the occasional scythe of spray. Her hair was blowing about in the slipstream. One of the Miriam's crewmen was up front, steering from behind a little perspex windshield. A bodyguard was sitting behind him, giving Greg and Gabriel the occasional impersonal glance. At least Toby wasn't on board. He managed to get his eyes above the gunwale. It had taken centuries to drain the original Fenland marshes and turn them into farmland. Generations had labored to liberate the rich black loam from the water, rewarded with the most fertile soil in Europe. The polar melt drowned them in 18 months. The Fen's basin wasn't a sea, it was mud, tens of meters thick, with a tackiness gradient that varied from a few centimeters of weed-clogged salt water on the surface down to near solid treacle. An ex-Fenman living in Oakham had once told Greg that it was possible to tell the age of a Fen's house by looking at its doorstep. The older it was, the more the loam would have dried out and contracted beneath it, leaving the doorstep high and dry. Really ancient cottages had a gap below the bottom of the stone in the ground. Greg couldn't see any doorsteps. On the few lonely farmhouses still visible, he was hard-pushed even to see the doors. 12 years of sluggish tidal suction had chewed out their foundations, pulling them down into the absorptive alluvial quagmire. Some of the sturdier buildings had managed to retain their shape, upper floors rising out of the brown glass surface over which the hovercraft were racing. But the majority had subsided into tiny flattened islands, with juncus rushes growing out of the shattered bricks and skeletal timbers. Ragged felt hems of blue-green algae encircled all of them. The hovercraft took a gently meandering course, avoiding the solid protrusions and swollen semi-submerged branches of dead copses in wide curves. Greg and Gabriel were following Kendrick's craft, slicing through the fine spray its passage whipped up. Behind them, the horizon was marked by a fine green line. The Neen levee, which meant they were heading approximately south. It didn't make any sense to Greg. There was nothing ahead of them. Nobody lived in the basin. Crabs and gastropods thrived in the nutrient-rich sludge, but no one could earn a living from catching them. An ordinary fishing boat would stick fast in the mud. Conceivably, a very light sail-powered catamaran or trimaran might be able to move about. And the idea of deploying nets or pots was laughable. In fact, hovercraft were just about the only vehicles which could be used successfully on the Fens Basin. From being the most fertile tract of land in Europe, the Fens had reverted into a zone of barren desolation, rivaling the Sicilian desert for inhospitableness. The sheer sameness of the quagmire was numbing Greg, bleeding away any last reserves of hope and defiance into the stifling atmosphere. Endless kilometers flowed past, compounding the sense of isolation. Gabriel had hunched up in her seat, defeated. His attention drifted. Analyzing his predicament was suddenly futile. tiresome in the heat and moisture. His thoughts began to freefall, wondering what Eleanor was doing right now. And please don't let Kendrick think she was important.
Greg.
The urgency in Gabriel's voice made him look round, quickly. A town was rising out of the horizon's uncompromising interface between brown and blue. It was like a mirage, its base lost in the black and silver ripples of shimmering inflamed air. Kendrick's hovercraft was powering straight for it, leading them in.
Hey.
The bodyguard sitting behind the pilot turned. Boredom reigning. What?
Where are we?
Greg asked. Wisbeach! Why? Does it make a difference? He should have known. Wisbeach was the harbinger. The self-declared capital of the Fens was the first instance of wholesale evacuation in England. At the start of the warming, excessive rains and record tides had sent the Nene cascading over its banks, and in those days the river ran straight through the centre of the town. Greg had remained glued to the flat screen for a week while pontoons of news channel cameras chugged through the flooded streets. He remembered the pictures of drowned orchards ringing the town, the sodden refugees slumped apathetically in Royal Marine assault boats, clutching pathetically small bundles of possessions. It was something out of the Third World, not England. The novelty of such scenes had paled rapidly in the months and then years which followed, as town after town succumbed to the water. Wisbeach only looked whole from a distance. Close up, it was in a sorry state. The outskirts had collapsed completely, leaving a broad inverted moat of rubble, protecting the town's heart from the larger vagaries of the swelling mud tides. Both hovercraft slowed, manoeuvring cautiously around hummocks coated in vigorous growths of reeds. The narrow channels between them were choked with algae, so thick in some places it resembled a green clay. It was stirred up by the hovercraft's downdraft, freeing pockets of rancid gas. Gabriel and the crewmen coughed and swore, clamping their hands over their faces. Greg couldn't smell a thing. His throat began to dry, though. Five metal street lamps marked one channel for them, miraculously remaining upright after all these years. The conical algal incrustations around them were actually solidifying, turning them into cartoon desert islands. From the height of the poles left above the surface, Greg guessed that the street must have been about 1.5 meters below the hovercraft. Further in, the mounds became more regular, the channels echoing the street pattern they covered. Sections of walls had survived here, triangular, cracked, and leaning at crooked angles. The brickwork was obscured by a viscid pebble dash of gull droppings. An eerie desynchronized harmonic from the electric fans was bouncing back off them, amplifying their natural soft purr to a vociferous clattering reverberation. Overhead, hundreds of gulls twisted in devious helices, calling shrilly, the high decibel feedback from the entire flock a brazen fortissimo rolling across the ruins. Greg realized it was impossible to creep up on Wisbeach. They swept out of the mounds and into a suburb that was still standing. Two-story houses bordering a light industrial estate. The mud came halfway up the ground-floor windows. There was no glass left in them. Second-story windows were shattered, crystalline shark teeth sticking out of mouldering frames. Walls bulged, roofs sagged alarmingly, shedding tiles like autumn leaves. Gutters were wadded with grass and bindweed. Moving on. The Nene's old course was a serpentine semi-liquid desert, 350 meters wide, flat and featureless. All embankment buildings had been pulverized by the febrile floodwater, their debris sucked away by the inexorable vortices generated by the clash between currents of salt water and fresh water. Since then, the eternal mud had oozed back, a great leveller. Wisbeach used to have a bustling port, the river lined by ugly warehouses and towering cranes. Greg had no way of telling where the Iron Titans had once stood. Both hovercraft picked up speed on the flat. The heat pressed down, magnified by still heavy air. Even the gulls abandoned the chase. Greg received a pernicious impression of waiting depth. He was eager to reach the other side. Their destination was becoming apparent straight ahead, on the other side of the old river course, the most prominent building there was. An old brick mill tower, slightly tapering, stained almost completely black with age. Greg didn't understand how it could have possibly survived until they arrived at its base, riding noisily across the buckled corrugated roof of a petrol station which was elevated half a meter above the mud. The tower had been built on the summit of a raised stony mound. While chaos and ruin had boiled all around, it had remained aloof and untouched. Tufts of tough Bermuda grass grew around its base. There was a good 2 meters of hard-packed earth between the bricks and the mud. The blades in front of the door were trampled down. Kendrick's hovercraft beached itself on the left of the door. Greg's drew up on the right. The pilot kept going until the bow was bumping the filthy brick, then killed the lift. The tower door opened and a man came out. He was 40-ish, dressed in a fawn sweatshirt and olive-green Wranglers. His shoes were black leather, polished to a sergeant major's shine. A brown belt holster held a Browning 9mm automatic. Kendrick and Hermione alighted from their hovercraft. Greg was hauled to his feet beside Gabriel. The man from the tower took in the fresh crimson splash down his shirt, the way he kept swaying from side to side. "You were told intact," he said to Kendrick. There was no deference shown. Kendrick seemed to be among equals at last.
"He can walk, he can talk,"
Kendrick retorted indifferently, and marched off into the tower.
"Uncuff them," said the man, "and get them upstairs. He's waiting."
The crewman began deflating the hovercraft. Mark unlocked the cuffs and waved them into the tower. Resignation had settled in long ago. Greg stepped across the door, shuffling like one of the undead, shamed and impotent. The basement was bare, brick walls and concrete floor, a smack of dampness in the air, but not as much as there should have been. He spotted a bright conditioning duct disappearing into the rude wooden plank ceiling. A deflated hovercraft of the same kind they'd arrived in sat in the middle of the floor. There was a cast-iron staircase opposite the door.
"Up," said Mark.
Shiny black shoes were already vanishing through the hole in the ceiling. The first floor was also one big room, appreciably drier, used for storing crates of food. There were quite a few Harrods hampers stacked beside a small grey metal desk. The second floor was a living room, carpeted in a thick steel-blue soft pile. Its furniture was modern, matching timber-framed leather chairs and settee, a low ceramic coffee table, and rose-teak executive desk with a recessed Olivetti terminal. Cupboards and a glass-fronted drinks cabinet were fixed to the wall, purpose-built. They fitted the shallow incline perfectly. Light shone through a single frosted glass window halfway up the wall. The brickwork had been left uncovered, scrubbed clean. The dumpy woman who'd accompanied Greg on the hovercraft was waiting at the top of the stairs, which was impossible, because she was following him up. Had to be twins. But that revelation was blown straight out of his mind by the next person he saw. Kendrick was talking earnestly to Leopold Armstrong. And Greg knew he'd finally met the person who'd organized the blitz on Philip Evans's corps. England's ex-president was 57, but still trim and fit. His meaty face had a few more lines than Greg remembered. His mop of neatly cut silver hair was combed back tidily. He wore a simple Shetland cardigan over an open-neck cotton shirt. So ordinary. Almost homely. Greg had thought he was beyond any further surprises, but he just stood and gawked until Gabriel bumped into his back, and her curse was sliced off in mid-flow as she caught sight of Armstrong. He looked both of them over, taking his time. The tip of his tongue moistened his lips. Greg registered the ridiculous urge to straighten his rumpled dinner jacket. Mark clattered up the stairs behind them and hustled them forward. The little living room was beginning to get crowded. Hermione had stretched out in one of the two leather chairs, feigning lethargy. In addition to the man who'd met them outside, there was another obvious hardliner hovering around Armstrong, just waiting for Greg to try something.
"Sit him down, Neville," he said, "before he falls."
The man who'd met them outside the tower stabbed his forefinger at the settee, and Greg collapsed into it gratefully. Gabriel joined him after a second thrust. His name had given Greg the key. placing the face. Astonishing the trivia a mind can hold. Neville Turner, junior Home Office Minister in the PSP government, second in command of the People's Constables, one of the many shadow figures orbiting Armstrong's periphery. Armstrong now held up Greg's Trinity's card, a prosecuting counsel with a blood-stained, fingerprinted knife.
"You're a Mind Star veteran," he said. "What on earth are you doing consorting with scum like this?"
He was setting the tone, speaking normally, no threats, no gloating dominance charades. The ex-president was concerned only with facts, reality. He didn't possess time to waste on life's inessentials.
"Only a total paranoid would be frightened of ghosts," Greg said.
The Trinity's card was pocketed.
"You mean Philip Evans?" Armstrong asked. "I admit the potential of that fancy NN core of his alarms me. He was remarkable when he only had a human brain. A giga-conductor with a transcendent Evans masterminding its marketing strategy will be a definite setback for me. He's so depressingly efficient at that sort of thing. A clever man. Pity we have opposing political viewpoints, but that's life. However, the conflict between Evans and me goes much deeper than that, as I'm sure you're aware."
Greg stared at him dumbly.
"Good Lord, he never told you, did he? Think on it, Mr. Mandel. You've seen Event Horizon's prowlers at work, I believe?"
"Yes."
No ultra-hush there. He wasn't giving anything away.
"Military hardware, Mr. Mandel. Good quality American military hardware, as provided by that vicious profiteering little arms merchant, Horace Jepson."
Greg started, and Leopold Armstrong caught it.
"Didn't you know? Oh yes, Mr. Mandel. Jepson is a U.S. government convenience. He sells to their allies, discreetly, mark you, and in return their IRS overlooks Globecast's somewhat irregular tax returns."
He shook his head.
"I don't know what all the fuss about you is. You're not half as good as everyone says. But then Mindstar never did fulfill its promise, did it?"
"You were worried enough, I remember," Greg said. "You and your People's Constables. Never had much joy catching us, though, did you?"
Armstrong pursed his lips.
"Quite. Well, now you have the facts. Make the connection."
Greg read the anger in his face, sharp, focused determination, riding him hard. Armstrong was vengeance-seeking, said his native intuition, a strong, clear message.
"My God," he said, wonderingly. "Philip Evans blew up Downing Street."
Gabriel threw Greg a quick, startled glance, then twisted sharply to look up at Armstrong.
"Very good, Mr. Mandel," said Leopold Armstrong. "The electron compression warhead was brought into the country by one of his prowlers, smuggled into Downing Street by his security division's hardliners. Kendrick here tells me Evans laughed when the warhead exploded. Thinks of himself as a more successful version of Guy Fawkes, no doubt. Très romantique. He obliterated me once, Mr. Mandel. Just believing I was dead was enough for the country to march in rebellion against the PSP. But now... now that bastard has exploited his money to do it to me again. To do it to all of us. Immortality, Mr. Mandel. He has bought himself immortality with his imperialist power, his obscene personal wealth. Another 20 years I'm good for, and a lot can be done in that time. But what is a pitiful 20 years to Evans now? He has eternity. He will see me dead again, for real this time. And do you know what the real ball kicker of it is? He won't even care. My actual death will be of supreme indifference to him, because to him, secure in his present incarnation, we are all less than nothing. That, Mr. Mandel, cannot be allowed to pass unchallenged. That is why I risked blowing my cover, all my preparations, because I am not going to allow him to escape death. Death is universal, making us all equal in the end.
How about you, Di Girolamo? Greg asked. You believe all this crap? You've got enough obscene personal wealth to translocate your memories like Philip Evans. You're gonna die when you don't have to.
Armstrong put on a pained expression.
Please, Mr. Mandel. Kendrick and I are not going to be driven apart by your desperation. Our mutual interests are too strong.
I can't figure you, Greg said to Kendrick. You knew about the giga-conductor. Yet you let Julia buy your family house out of the Event Horizon backing consortium. Why? You've kissed goodbye to a fortune.
A deal, Kendrick said thinly. In return for informing the president of Philip Evans's NN Corps, I will be given Event Horizon on a plate.
Not some derisory percentage. All of it.
After it's been nationalized, Armstrong interjected smoothly. Then, naturally, an international financier of Kendricks's stature would be a perfect choice as chairman. Regretfully, his appointment would have been difficult to justify if Evans Jr. had exposed his earlier impropriety, which is why he agreed to sever their financial link. But she won't be in a position to issue such paranoid ultimatums for much longer. After all, we can hardly allow a teenage girl to run a company so important to the country's economic prosperity now, can we?
Julia Evans will be stripped of her wealth and power, Kendrick said. He looked straight at Greg, smiling mechanically, a slim line of flawless white teeth showing. You understand, don't you, Mr. Mandel? You know how it is between Julia and me. There was a time when it was a fun game. She was an excellent player. But, unfortunately, she is too young. She does not fully comprehend the rules of this world. If I do not take Event Horizon from her, she will use it to harm me, my family house. What would you do in my place?
She understands the rules perfectly, Greg retorted. You just don't like losing. 17 years old and she can outsmart you from dawn till dusk. You shouldn't be worried, Kendrick. You should be terrified. But then you are, aren't you?
Kendrick's lips closed.
It is not I who will feel terror.
No? Greg asked, scornfully.
You even misjudged your new partner here. Armstrong isn't interested in vengeance. He's like you. He's after the giga conductor. You're just his front man. A cheap puppet.
You do have tenacity, don't you, Mr. Mandel? Armstrong said. Perhaps that's why Event Horizon hired you. But you're wrong. The money accrued from gigaconductor license production will be split between us. A valuable source of income to further my aspirations.
Aspirations? Said Gabriel. What aspirations?
Ah, yes, Miss Thompson, isn't it?
He affected to notice her for the first time.
My return to mainstream politics.
You can't be serious. You'll never resurrect the PSP.
Not the old party, no. It's a fool who doesn't learn from his mistakes. My new organization will be structured along different lines.
10 times, Greg said. You've been paying for 10 times and the rest of Charles Ellis's hot rod team to screw up all those companies.
Indeed, and my people have been quick to point out the inevitable failings of the free market system. There is a large groundswell of resentment building against the new conservatives and their mismanagement of the economy. One I intend to encourage.
Bollocks, Gabriel snorted. No matter how bad things get, nobody's going to vote for hard left policies again. You don't understand just how much people hated everything you stand for.
Miss Thompson, if you could still see into the future, you'd know that I'm not aiming for the Grand Slam this time. You can only ever do that once. I was very unlucky in that events beyond my control conspired to put an end to PSP rule. The energy crisis, the warming, the credit crash. No government could withstand that combination. Take a look around at other countries. How many of the leaders of 10 years ago remain in power today? We were the ones who were blamed. People don't like to blame their own greed and exorbitant lifestyles. They want someone to hold responsible. And government gets it in the neck every time. From outbreaks of food poisoning to hurricanes, blame the government.
From protesters being whipped to death in the street to seed potatoes being dished up on the tables of party members, Greg said.
Those kind of incidents were inevitable to start with. But the abuses were solvable, given time.
You had 10 years, Greg said. All they ever did was get worse.
The people who made up the PSP's local committees were unused to power. If they had been allowed to establish themselves, then we would have seen stability. But, of course, Mindstar and that plague of urban predator gangs incited trouble in the cities, goading the constables.
He flexed his hands in agitation.
We were misrepresented.
Gabriel laughed unsteadily.
What's the matter, Armstrong?
Did you think the hard left had a monopoly on political agitators?
For a moment, Greg thought he would hit her, but the ex-president eventually sighed resentfully.
This time I have settled for a more slow-burning form of reformation. There are thousands of my appointees still in place throughout the civil service, primed and waiting. The new Conservatives will soon have to order an intervention as the private and denationalized companies begin to falter, bringing them back into the government fold. My people will assume the management duties with a great deal of success, and I shall direct them, president in all but name and public visibility.
We'll fight you, Greg said levelly. We'll fight you with everything we've got, bows and arrows if that's all that's left. We've done it before, and we beat you before.
Yet here I am. This seems to be the month of miraculous comebacks.
He laughed and grinned round at the faces in the living room.
I do believe I'm talking to a reactionary. However, I don't intend to spend hours justifying my actions to you, Mr. Mandel, nor debating the pros and cons of centrally controlled economies. You were brought here to answer questions, and that is what you will now do.
Greg thought he must have flinched. Certainly, he stiffened.
No, no. We don't go around beating confessions out of people here. There are much simpler methods. But understand one thing, Mandel. You are going to die. Just as soon as you have provided me with every bite I require. How you die will be decided by your behavior. The old easy way or hard way. You can have a bullet through the head, quick and clean. Alternatively, you can be dumped into the old riverbed, alive and kicking.
It doesn't make one fuck of a lot of difference in the end, does it?
Armstrong picked up a cyberfax from the coffee table and sat in the last remaining leather chair.
Think about it, he said, knowingly. Dwell on it. You might find your attitude adjusting. Neville, we'll begin now.
Turner opened a drawer in the rose-teak desk and extracted a spaghetti tangle of nylon straps and optical fibers.
Take off your shirt,
he told Greg with a doctor's examining room impartiality. Greg thought about it. Refusing would be a rather trivial token. The shirt would only be cut or ripped off. Besides, he was thinking of being slung into that bottomless mud. God curse Armstrong. He struggled out of the jacket and began on the shirt buttons, flakes of dried blood wedged under his fingernails.
Good, Armstrong said. Quite an ironic twist for you, Mr. Mandel, I imagine. On the receiving end of a lie detector for once.
Turner velcroed a strap around each of Greg's wrists. They prickled, minute, needle-tipped sensors probing into his skin, tasting salinity, heat, conductivity, heart rate. The St. Christopher was flicked to one side, and another strap went round his neck, tightening noose-style. Leopold Armstrong's fingers drummed on his cyberfax.
I have a number of queries, and you'll answer each one honestly. For every lie you make, we'll break a bone in Miss Thompson's body. The bigger the lie, the bigger the bone. Understand?
Again, there was no malice. Leopold Armstrong was just telling it the way it was.
Yeah,
Greg replied, as a tiara band was placed on his head. Turner pressed an infuser against his arm. There was a bee sting of pain, turning to an ice spot.
Relaxant,
Turner said, and began plugging the optical cables into a gear module which was already interfaced with the Olivetti deck. The cube lit with scrawling sine waves. He sat in the swivel chair behind the desk and began typing. Data rolled down an LCD display.
Name?
He asked. The correlation went on for what seemed an age to Greg. The relaxant acted like a gentle influx of rosé wine, pleasantly inebriating, amplifying sounds like squeaking leather and rustling clothes, turning the air warm, drying his throat. Of course, he could still concentrate, if he wanted to. They seemed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of his life stored in the Olivetti. Stuff he could barely remember, secondary school exam results, army postings, nicknames of barrack mates, neighbours at the timeshare estate. Nothing recent, though. Nothing from the last couple of years.
He's ready,
Turner shouted out eventually. Armstrong consulted his cyberfax.
One. Does anyone on the mainland suspect I am alive?
Greg had worked out that this was a crux. To answer or not to answer. watching Gabriel being systematically snapped apart before him. The noise of all those cracking bones would be deafening. But they were going to die anyway. It would be very noble to confound Armstrong. Decisions, decisions. Gabriel was silent, unhelpful as always. The relaxant's health spa glow had seeped through his entire body, levitating him. He was back in the womb again, warm, cozy, and untroubled.
"No," he said. "Nobody knows."
Leopold Armstrong's smile illuminated the whole world.